Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Wednesdays are the day that you and I have the opportunity to meet a woman who's walked her own path and is willing to share it with us. Today's Women's Wednesday guest is quite interesting. She's actually an author who will be talking to us about a woman that she has researched and written about. I am very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Kelly Nicole Gross, who is the author of Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso, and it is a tale of race, sex, and violence in America. Dr. Gross, you've written about a disembodied torso. Do you do that often?
No, I don't. Thank you so much for having me. No, this was a first for me on many levels as a historian.
Well, it really is an amazing book. And now, tell the audience, if you would, a little bit about your background.
Sure. I don't know how much detail you want, but I did my work as an undergrad at Cornell in Africana Studies, and then I got my master's and my PhD in American Civilization and History. And I've always been interested on issues that have to do with race and gender and Black women's lives. And I became interested in studying those topics with respect to the criminal justice system after I was a volunteer team teacher in a women's prison. That was the first time I realized that the issues around mass incarceration and race didn't just disproportionately affect Black men, they also disproportionately affected Black women too. And so my first book and my early research focused on Black women's experiences in the criminal justice system in the late 19th or early 20th centuries.
And today we are talking about, again, Hannah Mary Tabbs. And tell us when Hannah was born. And this is a true story.
It is a true story. So Hannah Mary Tabbs actually stumbled across her and her case when I was doing research for the first book. And as soon as I came across it, I knew it deserved its own monograph. She was a Black woman who had been arrested for this crime in Philadelphia, and the prison administrators actually maintained a scrapbook about their most sort of infamous prisoners, and so she was among them. And the reason I'm telling you this is because part of what it took for me to figure out where she was from had to do with me navigating her own sort of narratives and distortions about her life. So initially, she told these folks that she was from Virginia, Richmond specifically. I'd been trying to locate her there historically before I came across some other documents that confirmed she actually had been born in Maryland in the 1850s. And she was from Anne Arundel County, which had a sort of very notorious and violent slave-owning family. So I've sort of taken that to mean that the texture of enslavement, which was brutal all across the country, appeared to have some specific dynamics in this particular county, and it was a very large slave-owning family. Now, I haven't been able to confirm if she herself was enslaved or not, but, you know, even sort of, you know, quote-unquote being free in these kind of spaces in this time is really nebulous, and all Black people were pretty subject to some really racist violence and brutality, whether they were enslaved or, you know, not enslaved.
And certainly as a Black woman, there was much that she was rightfully concerned about in terms of her own safety.
Right. So Black women and girls were especially vulnerable during enslavement. I mean, you know, their rape had basically been incentivized by the laws and the practices in that their offspring would basically swell masters' holdings. So, and this particular moment is difficult because, you know, she's born in the 1850s, but then you have, you know, when she's around 10 or 11 years old, the Civil War, which was one of, you know, the most bloody and brutal in our country. you know, roughly 2% of the population died in this war. So it's a really vicious time. Maryland actually was occupied. And so by the time the war's end, she kind of emerges from this period as a young girl on the precipice of womanhood. She would have been about 15 or 16. So incredibly vulnerable to violent, to sexual assault and exploitation. And there's some evidence that she may well have been victimized. She leaves Anne Arundel County and migrates north to Baltimore. And basically, by the time she reaches Baltimore, she has a mulatto girl in tow. Now, she refers to the girl as her niece, but, you know, we later come to find out that there's a lot of evidence that this is, in fact, her biological child, but the circumstances surrounding the girl's birth are pretty convoluted. Not clear if it was the product of a rape or some sort of exploitative situation that she was in.
Well, as we meet Mary in the book, Mary is she's an adult, and she's early on we follow her as she gets on the train and she takes a train ride and.
Right. So I first meet Hannah Mary Tabbs in the headlines when it's discovered that she had thrown a headless, limbless, racially ambiguous male torso off of a bridge onto the bank of a pond in a city just outside of Philadelphia.
Okay, let's back up a second.
Yes.
Mary, Hannah Mary Tabbs, grew up in times when... As a woman of color, not at all safe for her. And you're saying that she actually threw a torso, minus the head, minus the legs, minus the arms, off a bridge.
Yes, ma'am.
So Mary, so she was an Amazon, right? I mean, she was like nine feet tall.
So this is complicated. Mary is a complicated figure. In some respects, she has the life of a typical sort of black woman in Philadelphia at this time, right? It's after the Civil War, after slavery. It's also after Reconstruction, where there's this moment in the sun where black people are actually enfranchised as citizens, and you have black people getting voted into office in the South. Then when that all collapses in 1877, you know, you have sort of the rise of this sort of, you know, anti-black kind of, you know, virulent white racism, the Klan, Knight Rider. This is the sort of era where, you know, the widespread lynching of blacks is born. So she, you know, like many African Americans, leaves, you know, the South for parts north. So when she gets to Philadelphia, you know, even, you know, she's married someone in Baltimore. She's raising her, you know, her quote-unquote niece. They are in Philly. They try to make a life of it, and she has a good track record for getting jobs. She's a noted cook by all accounts, very good, sought after. But within her own community, she was a different sort of figure entirely, one who could be incredibly violent and intimidating, one who colored outside of the lines with respect to her sexuality and how she navigated marriage. And she could also be the type of person who could carry a headless, limbless torso roughly a mile to a train, get on the train, get off, carry it to a bridge, and throw it off.
And, I mean, just the, you know, I'm thinking about the mindset of somebody who can actually do that, which is probably a whole other conversation. But let's back up a bit. What was the sort of typical life of a black woman during that time?
Right. So most black women who were in Philadelphia, a good percentage of them were actually Southern migrants, many from Virginia, and then the other part, the next largest group was from Maryland. So she was very sort of similar to, you know, that population of demographics who came to the city. 90% of black women who worked in the city worked as domestics. So she, again, was very in line with, you know, other black women in her age group. She worked for domestic service for years. As I said, she was a cook, really highly esteemed for her skills. She was married. You know, she was, by all accounts, law-abiding. At least, you know, in the eyes of the Philadelphia Police Department, she didn't have any sort of criminal record or anything until this event. So her life is really interesting to me because in some respects, it really encapsulates this combination of, you know, the extraordinary and the mundane, right? On one hand, she's like many other black women, but then again, there's this whole other side to her that makes her completely distinct.
And it's interesting, you make the point that as violent as she was within her own community, and people were literally afraid of her, she was never arrested for any of the violence that she doled out to members of her community, making the point that black-on-black crime, police weren't all that interested in it, didn't really care about it.
Right. Well, so all crime is intra-racial, right? And by that I mean black people commit crime against black people, white people commit crimes against white people.
Right.
But in this particular moment in time, the police, right, black people then as now in many respects were very much sort of, you know, removed from adequate police protection. They're not able to go to the courts and get sort of impartial treatment. So, you know, in fact, they were racially profiled during this time period. It was completely expected that police would brutalize suspects, beat up criminals. So, you know, racial profiling was written into police manuals. And black Southern migrants and also immigrants from outside of the U.S. were particularly vulnerable because in Philadelphia, police had instructions to detain anybody who looked like they had come to the city, you know, from someplace else. You have examples of black folks being stopped and detained because police don't believe they own goods that they're carrying.
Sounds familiar.
You know, yeah, well, and this was sort of the surprise for me. You know, someone who does research of the late 19th or early 20th century, I mean, you know, I was horrified by how similar the issues, you know, still are. So there's that piece of it, but this, to answer your question, one of the things that Hannah Mary Tabbs was really good at was sort of capitalizing off of black people's sort of dislocation from the criminal justice system. You know, she knew how to carry herself in the white world, right? She didn't put a toe out of line when she worked in these white homes or for white employers. But she knew in the black community where people didn't have access to police protection or anything like that, that there were many, many activities and behaviors that she could do and get away with where she would, you know, that would go unpunished. I mean, case in point, even the homicide that she's involved in, the big reason that the police took the case so seriously was because they weren't certain if the victim was a white man or not. And so that was the reason why it even got so much sort of attention initially, is that they were really concerned that a white man had been murdered. By the time they figured out that the victim was, in fact, you know, a quote-unquote mulatto, this is the term they used for the time to describe someone who was mixed, you know, the story itself had already gotten, you know, legs and become a kind of sensation. So it was carried, you know, to fruition based on those issues.
So, again, not very different from the world that we reside in today. Tell us a little bit about her husband. You suggested that her approach to marriage was interesting.
Interesting, certainly unconventional for the ways that I think I and many of us think about marriage in general, but particularly marriage in the late 19th century. Her husband, John Tabbs, was, by all accounts, a pretty good guy. He was significantly older than her, roughly 15 years older. He met and married her in Baltimore. According to him, she was very, quote, ignorant and foolish. And so he sent her to school so she could get, I guess, sort of trained up. But he also described her as always being crazy. What's interesting about John Tabbs, though, is that he was sort of my guiding light in terms of doing research into the case. Because whenever I came across evidence that Hannah Mary Tabbs had put forward or had, you know, managed to get into evidence, you know, it usually ended up being untrue. But when John Tabbs went on record with something, I was often able to verify it. So he was sort of my guiding light. He was someone who fought during the Civil War as a part of the colored troops. And that experience, he ended up having a pretty serious injury. The records indicate that he was ruptured in the groin. So at some point, it seems that he and his wife had navigated or worked out an arrangement where he sort of looked the other way or tolerated her extramarital affairs, I think because he may have suffered from impotence or was unable to perform sexually.
So she was, in some ways, from where she stood, having the best of both worlds. She had the husband who was the older man, who was certainly acceptable within the community, and then she had her dalliances, if you will, on the side, only they didn't tend to stay very healthy very long.
They didn't stay happy very long. I also will throw out this other perk for her. They also were about 10 years younger. So she had these younger men on the side. One of the things that first made me realize that they had worked out this arrangement is during the investigation, police uncover her lover's clothes in the house that she shared with her husband.
Which is pretty amazing.
So it is pretty amazing. So at that point, I couldn't figure out what was going on. You know, I had to step out of my box and try to imagine a variety of scenarios taking place before I came across the Civil War, you know, information about his injury. Then it all started to fall into place. But that said, it seemed like they worked out some ground rules, because even though his clothes were in their home and even the neighbors testified that this young man was at their house every day while John Tabbs was at work, he had never actually seen him face to face. So they must have had some arrangement where, you know, she kind of carried on this relationship, but, you know, he didn't sort of bring the guy in his face, basically. So it was an extraordinary sort of thing to stumble on, especially in this period, because black women were so vulnerable to rape and sexual assault. Most black women during this period were trying really hard to adhere to the politics of respectability. And a big part of that was trying not to project anything sexual, because the last thing they wanted to do was, you know, give off or invite any kind of undue or unnecessary attention, you know, lest they be accused of, you know, sort of, you know, asking for whatever sexual assault might sort of befall them. Mm-hmm. So most black women were sort of doing anything and everything to conceal their sexuality at this moment in time. So the fact that, you know, sort of find this woman who managed to sort of work out kind of the best of both worlds, right? On the face of it, she was really respectable. She was a married wife and, you know, an aunt taking care of her orphaned niece. You know, she was, you know, had steady jobs that were, you know, typically fairly well paying, you know, and then behind the scenes, it was a completely different situation.
It really is. I mean, extraordinary is not even the word for it. Again, when you think about the times and the difference between who Mary was in one part of town and who Mary was in another part of town. And you're right, this arrangement that she and her husband worked out, again, we hear about those kinds of arrangements even today, but we don't expect to hear about them in those times.
No, I certainly was unprepared for it. But this is, to me, is sort of the point or the beauty of looking at different kinds of figures in history. Right now, most of the histories that we have on black women focus on women who have managed to succeed in spite of these incredible odds, right? Folks who are highly respectable. And we need those histories. I get that completely. And especially to push back against these racist ideas that black women, you know, don't have history or haven't achieved anything. So those works are completely necessary. But we need to also look at some of these figures that don't quite fit that mold either, because we get a better range of black women's experiences, and it just opens up some other sort of topics or areas that, you know, we had never really known about. I mean, I knew, for example, that policing was biased in Philadelphia. You know, that was nothing new. But the extent of it and how similar it is to today was really sort of brought into high relief for me by looking at how this woman was moving in between the black and white communities.
And certainly within the white communities, not even particularly paying attention to her. Dr. Gross, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Callie Nicole Gross and A Tale of Race, Sex, and Violence in America. Dr. Gross, who was George Wilson in all of this?
Right. So George Wilson is the young man who, once they discover the identity of the unfortunate owner of said disembodied torso, the police actually quickly stumble onto Hannah Mary Tabbs. She gets arrested. She is taken into custody and I believe brutalized in a variety of ways. So much so that the next day she makes a confession, and there should be deep quotes around this word, because what she confesses to is to someone else committing the crime, and that would
be a young man
named George Wilson.
So she blamed George for the murder she created.
She blames George. George came over. George had a fight. George killed Gaines. George chopped up the body. George forced her to carry this torso and get rid of it.
Poor George.
George was an unlucky figure in this story in many ways. So he has this sort of, the other thing that works against George are two things. One, George is a young man also who lived around the corner from Hannah Mary Tabb. So she knew him from the neighborhood. He apparently knew her niece, and he had some kind of affiliation with Hannah Mary Tabbs as well, though I never could get a full sense of what the parameters of that relationship was. But he also was a very, very light complexion mulatto, light enough that he could actually pass for white. And this is at a moment in time historically where, you know, the word, you know, all these fears about miscegenation and race mixing are taking center stage. There's all this concern that there are going to be people like George Wilson, you know, infiltrating white society. So there are a variety of fears about someone like him. So when he gets implicated and the police sort of set eyes on him, you know, he sort of becomes much more suspicious to them than Hannah Mary Tabbs, even though she's having this illicit relationship with a guy, and there's a whole bunch of evidence on record that the relationship was very volatile, that they fought a lot, that she actually slashed his face with a razor at one point. You know, she threatened to kill him. All of that sort of goes out the window for the police when they sort of put eyes on Wilson. There are two other significant things that do work against Wilson. One is that he had prior experience working in an abattoir or a slaughterhouse. So this gives him, you know, for in their minds, right, the skill set that he had the knowledge about how to sort of dismember a body. And also, too, he had been in a juvenile home as a child. And this is sort of the sad thing because it criminalizes him in a certain way, though his, you know, placement in the juvenile facility is because his mother dies when he's like 8 years old. His family was pretty destitute. So his placement in the House of Refuge spoke more about those circumstances than any sort of, you know, litany of bad behavior or criminal activity on his part. But nonetheless, it works against him in this instance.
The idea that Hannah was on the train. I mean, you describe a time when she's on the train and people are talking about this woman they saw on the train. And as today, people couldn't quite come together in terms of what this woman actually looked like, which I think delayed Hannah's arrest. Am I correct in that?
Right. So if we go back to that early part of the story, after she dumps this torso, what she basically does is she goes back to this town, actually, to figure out what's going on, what the investigators know. And so they basically figure out, you know, that she ends up facing the same people who saw her, supposedly saw her the night before, but don't recognize her. And I think it speaks to this way in which Black people are at once sort of highly visible, but also somehow indiscriminate.
Yes.
You know, so they knew they saw a Black, right? They saw a Black at some point. But, you know, beyond that, the folks who, you know, had come into contact with her the night before didn't recognize her the next day.
And, you know, just the whole, you know, picture of her carrying this body wrapped in,
it was calico and this heavy paper marked handle with care.
And she sat by
the
window.
I was undone by that.
Yeah. She sat by the window. She wanted the windows open. I mean, so she, again, very interesting young woman. So
she did some interesting things.
Now, when she was actually, let me back up on myself for a moment. So she implicates this young man. The police bring him in and they agree or believe her statements about the fact that he was the prime mover in this crime?
They do. Despite, you know, her motive, despite evidence about her violence in the Black community, despite evidence that she had slashed the victim's face before and threatened to kill him, despite evidence that, you know, he thought the victim before he died thought she tried to poison him on a separate occasion, they instead hone in on this young man. And they're, you know, as the primary. And the other, I just mentioned one other fact. There are several folks in the Black community who feel really bad that Wilson ends up embroiled in this case. They sort of feel like he kind of tangled with a viper in some respects. And that by accounts, they described him as being somewhat slow.
Okay.
So the concern or the sentiment I gathered from the Black community was that, you know, Tabs had somehow manipulated and taken full advantage of this kind of slow kid and was now sort of hanging up the whole murder on him. And the police also kind of took advantage of him. I mean, they beat him up in custody. And then when they took him out to sort of supposedly point out where he had, you know, dumped other remains, they also had given him liquor, you know, and interviewed him again. So they did a number of things that, you know, put him in a position where he easily incriminated himself. But very little of the evidence against Wilson could be corroborated. In fact, there was some indication that he may have even had an alibi when a letter carrier you know, which was, you know, the 19th century version rather than postman, basically testified to having seen him in the shop where he worked, at that point a chair caning factory, on the day and the time in question with respect to when this murder was supposedly taking place. But he ended up being largely prevented from putting that testimony into evidence.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is that the police and the sort of the justice system, if you will, they decided who was guilty, and then they created this scenario to quote-unquote prove what they believed to be true, despite evidence to the contrary. That never happens today.
Well, never happens today. And also, too, they also had to add on top of this that you have Hannah Mary Tabbs, who really, really knows how to play white folks, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So she plays up on this kind of white nostalgia, you know, in the North for, you know, these days when, like, black people basically knew their place. So she never looks white people directly in the eye. She always keeps her eyes down. She really turns on kind of the Southern accent. You know, she yes ma'ams them and, you know, no sirs them to death. She, you know, weeps in court. She starts to refer to her niece as her daughter, which I think is a move designed to associate herself with motherhood.
Gotcha.
You know, so she, you know, basically pulls out all the stops in court. And basically, I think for the white jurors and the judge, she becomes the more trustworthy black, right? This is the black person they recognize.
Exactly.
Right? She's visibly black. She's got this accent. She's deferring to white authority, right? She is a female, which is a miracle. Most black women, they didn't, you know, didn't matter if you were female. The justice system threw the book at black women, a lot of times more so even than black men, particularly in Philadelphia. But she kind of pulls off this, you know, this, she pulls off the ruse in a way where they actually see her femininity. And so they decide at this point that, you know, they don't know what fully happened, but they don't believe that this woman could have committed this crime.
And
that she must have just been forced into this thing after the fact.
Let me ask you about her daughter/niece. There was some earlier issue with the disappearance of that person,
right,
that she also blamed on this same gentleman, didn't she?
Well, so she went, and when her niece had been missing, she also suggested that he had been involved in that. But there were other people in the black community who had come forward, and they all thought that Hannah Mary Tabbs had actually killed the girl. So and people had even sent anonymous letters into the precinct, right, charging that she had killed her niece and also saying that she killed someone else before she migrated. Now, I could never find evidence of that, but again, I found it very difficult to trace her background because she had put so much sort of misinformation into the record that it was kind of hard to sort of find her at all, let alone to discover whether or not she had been the suspect in another murder in another state. But the issue is that her niece ends up being found. They find the niece in New Jersey working as a domestic. And she tells the authorities that Hannah Mary Tabbs was jealous of the attention that the victim was giving her. And so she had taken to sort of beating her unmercifully. The girl feared for her life, and she ran away.
And so, that seems to fit with the Hannah Mary who you've been describing all along.
Right, that this is the Hannah Mary at home and in the community, right? Someone very different from the Hannah Mary who shows up demurring to white authority, crying openly and visibly shaking in the courtroom. So she managed to have, you know, white people just couldn't believe that she would, you know, be guilty of these things, whereas, you know, George Wilson, you know, he's this young kind of tough, you know, he has the audacity to sit there looking white. You know, he also, you know, as I said, they thought he was a little bit slow. So he seemed kind of fascinated by the notoriety surrounding the case, which also was sort of read against him as, like, you know, someone just of low character, you know, he didn't have any remorse. You know, there are all these things that, you know, suddenly made him seem a lot more suspicious than her, which I was astonished by.
Let's talk a little bit about the person that Hannah is believed to have killed.
So I never had a real clear sense of who that other victim was. There was a note. There were two notes that were sent to the police, the chief of detectives, during the investigation. One charged that Hannah Mary Tabbs was responsible for the death of Wakefield Gaines, who in this instance was, you know, as I said, the unfortunate owner of the torso, and also that she had killed another man. The letter had said that she had killed another man in Richmond, but it also described a place called the Meadow. Now, both Richmond and Maryland and Baltimore areas have places that people refer to as the Meadow. So it was never certain. It was definitely someone who knew her and who was aware of the stories that she told about herself. But I could never figure out if she had, in fact, killed another man before she had migrated to Philadelphia.
All right, so
his second letter had, you know, again, just said that she was a really dangerous customer and people should, you know, not mess with her and be careful.
All right, so we've got Hannah Mary. She's got her husband. She's got the other gentleman. And now we're talking about the man with whom she had an affair. And apparently, as you describe her, she was almost obsessed with him. She tried to exert a great deal of control over him, and he had the audacity to plan to marry somebody else.
Well, this is apparently what led, I think, very quickly to his unfortunate and untimely demise. So the two had this, you know, hot and heavy relationship. It had gone on for a little over a year or so. She had, you know, according to, you know, the niece, had fallen in love with Gaines and basically, you know, expected to marry him once, quote-unquote, old Tabs was dead. So, you know, she had designs on this young man for the duration. His affections were a little bit, you know, a little bit more fleeting. And so it came to a head when she learned that he had proposed to marry another black woman. And this is the argument where she confronts him outside of his sister's home with a razor and slashes his face. And he runs off, blood, you know, of course, gushing. She tells him that she's going to catch him and kill him yet. So this is when things really start to sour.
So while she's being unfaithful to her husband, and openly so, she was demanding absolute faith and honor from her lover. And when she found out that he was kind of doing what she was doing, she was not so happy.
She was not so happy. But now here's what I'll say, a small thing about Tabs. I think that she and her husband had worked out an arrangement.
Okay.
So it was certainly extramarital, but I believe that John Tabbs knew about it. I just think she made certain not to, like, flaunt it directly in his face. But that said, she also had been physically violent with her husband. So, you know, her desire to dominate and control the people in her life was pretty complete, you know, from the niece to the husband to the lover to neighbors in the community. You know, people knew really not to mess with her, that she would not hesitate to lash out in a violent way.
So clearly she learned somewhere along her own path that the way to be safe for her was to be violent.
Was to be violent. And, you know, one of the things that I try to stress in the book, and in my other work as well, you know, that violence, like any sort of physical activity, right, you know, it takes conditioning. You know, no one sort of wakes up with the ability to sort of, you know, whip someone's butt and win, especially a woman, you know, beating up a man.
Right.
Right? That you have to have some experience with fighting. You've had to lose a lot before you learned how to win. So I tried to use the record of her violence to try to think about or read trauma back into her past, right? That this violence doesn't just come from anywhere.
Exactly.
But it has a history and a context.
Callie, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation about Hannah Mary Tabbs. Don't go away, folks. Kelly, one other thought that I had about Hannah when she was actually in the courts was that would have perhaps served in her favor was her appearance. She had a missing front tooth, her clothes were tattered, she had a black eye, so she also didn't look very strong and powerful.
No, I mean, this is certainly true. You make a really good point. She definitely was a pitiable figure in court. And that black eye, I'm actually glad you brought it up, because that was also the subject of some speculation, that she reportedly had it on the day of the murder, and that it became more sort of contused after her night in custody. And this is also when her coat was torn, and she, you know, I think suffered pretty mightily in police custody.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely do agree that she probably did, you know, look pretty frail and fragile. She looked the part, and she definitely knew how to play it up.
So at the end of this trial, what were the findings?
So this was intense. So, you know, you have this trial. She testifies against Wilson. And one of the things that was also, I'm laughing, but it's not funny. I think it was more just sort of shock. Is that every answer that she gave was basically to the best of her recollection, right? So when asked about, you know, whether or not she had an affair with the victim, absolutely not. No, she never had any, you know, intimate relationship with him or anything to the best of her recollection. When asked about if she had used any names or introduced herself as some, you know, as his aunt or you know, his relative, which is a lot of what she did when she went to visit the victim at his, you know, rooming house. You know, no, she never was known by anything other than her married name, right, to the best of her recollection. You know, so everything was basically contingent upon that. And so there were, you know, she just, every answer she just sort of, you know, darted, you know, batted it away with that. I would have thought that the jury would have been completely unmoved by it or that it would have seemed disingenuous. But in the end, the judge basically decides that, you know, if nothing else, her story was consistent. You know, it's more likely that these men fought, that the guy, you know, probably did it. So he actually gets convicted and is initially sentenced to hang, which was a shock. Many people in the black community, everyone just stunned by the whole thing. And so what ultimately ends up happening, though, is that they immediately appeal because his attorneys make the argument that, you know, the procedure had been really unfair, that the judge had given, you know, bad instructions to the jury, and they were pretty leading. that he had made errors in some of the decisions that he made, particularly, I think, you know, disrupting the letter carrier's testimony and all the rest. So the appeal is granted, but in the end, they work out a plea. And so to sort of save him, you know, from the noose, as it were, he ends up taking a plea, and he goes to Eastern for about 10 years, Eastern State Penitentiary.
For 10 years. And Mary?
Yes. She gets convicted as an accessory after the fact. She gets a 2-year sentence that is reduced to 16 months.
And how did it get reduced?
Well, the judge basically, you know, they sort of go and appeal, and the attorneys work on her behalf, and they decide to give her time served for the time that she was in custody during the trial.
Interesting. So at the end of the 16 months, George is still in jail, Wakefield is dead, and Hannah is out and free.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I didn't hear you. Broke up.
After 16 months of being in jail for Hannah.
Yes.
She's out. Wakefield is dead. George is still in jail.
For
and
a long time.
Hannah's out. Just, what did she do?
She is released. And as soon as she gets out, it turns out that her husband dies. So I initially, it seemed really coincidental. So I had to really go back and verify the dates. He died literally about a month before she was released.
Interesting.
So she gets out. Her husband has died. She goes back to Baltimore. And, you know, she has a brother and a stepfather who is still living. So she hooks up with him and his wife. And it's in Baltimore where she actually applies for and gets a widow Civil War pension for John Tabb's service in the colored troops during the Civil War.
That's amazing. She's an amazing woman.
She was incredible to me in many respects. That blew my mind. And that find actually is what sort of helped me understand, you know, about her husband's injury, about their relationship, about more of her sort of family in the Baltimore area, the Civil War, her application for the pension file actually contained a lot of information, including her signature. She had, in fact, learned how to read and write.
So
she wrote her own name, too.
That's interesting. So all in all, Hannah, it sounds like Hannah was born at a time when violence against women, and particularly black women, was the order of the day. She grew up in violence. She learned it. She practiced it. And then at the end of her life, was she any different?
So from what I'm able to tell, there are a couple of things that, again, made it difficult to trace. So she continued sort of using different names and aliases. So it was harder to sort of trace her in Baltimore, but she continued doing work for domestic service. She was not arrested again. And all evidence suggests that she did in fact remarry.
You know, there's so many potential diagnoses that are floating around in my head.
Right.
As I'm listening to the story of Mary, do we know anything about the niece / daughter other than her report that Mary was so violent towards her? Do we know what path her life took?
No, I lost track of her. And that probably is because at some point she married and you know, changed her maiden name. So I was unable to sort of trace her down. Wilson was difficult to follow, too, though he does survive his sentence. He, too, eventually gets married. There are some indications that he was, though, arrested again later on, but it was for, like, shoplifting. But the evidence that I have for him is that he lived well below the poverty line for the bulk of his life.
Interesting. And of course, Mary had the pension and then she got remarried. So Hannah Mary sounds like she was kind of doing just fine.
She landed on her feet, that's for sure.
The parallels, the similarities between then and now, as you have identified them, I mean, certainly with the profiling, which we know happens today, and with the brutality that we know happens today, with the ways in which Black people, Black men, and Black women are seen, which we know happens today, at the end of your research, do you feel, well, tell me what it felt like for you to see how similar, albeit different, today is to those days.
So I was pretty horrified by it. I mean, a big part of me, you know, as a late 19th century historian doing this work, the last thing I expected to do was to be able to see so clearly parallels between then and now. I mean, that was probably the most astonishing and the most depressing piece of this research. Is one of the things I neglected to say about Wilson, too, that also was deeply troubling for me. The fact that he was in a juvenile home as a child, even that pointed to this early sort of cyclical kind of institutionalization.
Yes.
Because I did research into his family background. It turns out that his mother had been an inmate of that institution as well as a child. So there were all of these very early kinds of examples of the ways that Black people's lives had been sort of on a collision course with the justice system and with these sort of institutionalized kinds, you know, with institutionalization in general. It was really hard to see. The other piece that was difficult for me, too, is that, you know, in some respects, Hannah Mary Tabbs sort of managed the extraordinary in that she was able to sort of wring out a life for herself where she got to be fairly self-determining in certain ways, in ways where there wasn't really a lot of space for Black people, to Black women especially, to sort of be so. And I feel, in my opinion, I think many of the same kinds of limitations for Black womanhood still exist. I mean, there is a pressure for Black women to be respectable, to, you know, adhere to this idea of ideal marriage and motherhood, to never say a bad word, to never be flawed, right? There, you know, but that while those demands are there, the space for Black women to actualize their freedom and womanhood remain really constricted.
The sense that history repeats itself and is repeating itself even as we speak, certainly with respect to the lives of Black men and Black women, what do you look forward to for the future?
Now that's a tough one. That is a tough question. I am not hugely optimistic going forward. I'm really concerned about what kind of turn criminal justice is going to take in this country, particularly at this moment. So in many respects, I feel like it is particularly perilous for Black people right now. And that in some respects, I do sort of wonder if we are to sort of live and you know, enjoy the benefits of citizenship if it does not mean that we're going to have to live and sort of color outside of the lines in some respects. Mind you, not to the extremities that we find in this case.
Right? That's
good.
Heaven
forfend. Heaven forfend. But certainly it seems like we're at a moment where we're going to have to find some new and creative ways to make a way for ourselves, because we're not going to be able to rely on justice and very likely the federal government.
For those reading about Hannah Mary Tabbs today, particularly young women who may be reading about her, what do you want them to take away from her story?
I think I want them to know that in spite of her flaws, that Black womanhood in general, whether we are, you know, angels and really respectable, or whether we have done, you know, committed some unspeakable acts, that all of it is important and significant and worthy of historical study, and that a person like Hannah Mary Tabbs is not necessarily someone to be idealized, but that her life nonetheless is really important, that it has significant and important stories for us, messages for us, particularly with respect to the impact of trauma and violence on a person's life and the way that it can distort people and lead them to do some incredibly horrific things.
The existence of trauma in her life, indeed, trauma in the lives of most, if not all, Black people who were living during that time. As we look at the world today, the particular type of trauma experienced may not be so different. It may come out in a different way. It may have, you know, a different texture to it, but essentially it seems like it's the same thing.
I think I'm not understanding your question fully.
The trauma that Hannah Mary Tabbs experienced, and indeed the trauma that most Black people, if not all Black people, experienced during Hannah's time, is essentially the same thing that is happening today.
I see. Now, I definitely do think, right, that we are at this moment where the height of anti-Blackness and violence against Black people's lives and Black bodies is startlingly similar. And that we have started to see some of this, not same, but troubling responses as well. I mean, in the most constructive cases, right, you have people organizing collectively to try to, you know, seek out justice and to demand for things like police accountability. But, I mean, we've also had, you know, other actions that have been far more violent and seem to be sort of in retaliation to that brutality as well. So I definitely think there are a lot of parallel moments, but what is undiagnosed, I think, then as now, is right what the overall collective trauma for us is in terms of the cost of bearing witness to this brutality and violence. And I think for me, Tabs is sort of a scary meditation on some of that. But I think about that for our own times as well. I mean, we, you know, in Tabs's era, they saw bodies hanging from the tree, right? In our time, we have the videos. Right, we see people who are unarmed, gunned down in front of loved ones, in front of children, right, running away with their backs turned.
Right.
It's still no justice. And I think that that is traumatizing as well.
Absolutely.
In a variety of ways.
We've even seen a couple of hangings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
So it absolutely is traumatizing. And, you know, I mean, that's probably another conversation for us to have at another time, the impact of a history of trauma on the lives and the psyche of who we are today. But that is for another time. Is there a website or a place where people can go to learn more about Hannah Mary Tabbs and all the work that you're doing?
Oh, yes. They can look. They can check it out on CallieNicoleGross.com. I have stuff about the book and Hannah Mary Tabbs. I also have other examples of my writing and op-ed pieces and appearances.
Wonderful. And that's K-A-L-I-N-I-C-O-L-E. GROSS.com.
Yes.
Perfect.
One word.
Mm-hmm. Callie, thank you very much for joining us today and spending time teaching us about Hannah Mary Tabbs.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for having me. This was a wonderful interview.
Thank you. And, folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work, any study that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at myndtalk.org and also available by downloading the iTunes iTunes app. And again, it's available to you on demand whenever you choose. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. And if you'd like to be in touch with me, you can always send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that is mindtalk.org. And I want you to always remember, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.